Hello, thank you for joining me. This is Paul Saunders with the Center for the National Interest, and welcome to another episode of Three Questions. Some may remember a few weeks ago, I did an interview with myself as a little bit of an experiment, and I got quite good feedback from that. So I'm going to try that again this time, and hopefully it'll be equally interesting for everyone. What I'd really like to talk about this time is the big announcement out of the Russia-China meetings recently in Beijing, that the two countries have finally signed an agreement on the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline. So the first question is what is that? So Power of Siberia 2 is a natural gas pipeline. It would run from Western Siberian gas fields in Russia through Mongolia to China. That's the plan. The capacity that's been discussed is 50 billion cubic meters of natural gas per year, which is, you know, roughly equivalent to what Russia would have been exporting to Europe through the Nord Stream 2 pipeline under the Baltic Sea, had that been continuing to operate, which of course it isn't. And Nord Stream 2, of course, being only, you know, a portion of much larger Russian pipeline gas exports to Europe that no longer exist because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. This would be a long, complicated, very expensive pipeline, you know, tens of billions of dollars, potentially decades of operations. Second question, you know, why should this matter to particularly to people in the United States, but, you know, also to others in other places? I think there are several reasons. The first one to keep very much in mind is, you know, natural gas markets. Now, we don't know all of the terms of this agreement yet. It looks like a framework agreement. It looks like there's a lot that remains to be negotiated on the price and some other important contract terms. But if this pipeline moves ahead, and certainly the momentum seems to be kind of shifting that way, then this means China taking kind of more gas from Russia. And because of the loss of Russia's ability to export gas to Europe, that means China is kind of potentially importing natural gas that currently isn't being exported or sold anywhere else. This is kind of entirely new from that perspective. And kind of more importantly, gas that China wouldn't be buying, you know, from other natural gas exporters such as the United States and Qatar, each of which is a pretty significant liquefied natural gas market participant. So companies that are exporting from those three countries may have kind of fewer opportunities in China than they anticipated in the future. Secondly, China had been for some time hesitant to sign this agreement, and we don't really know why China was hesitant to sign it. There could be a variety of reasons for that. You know, one is uncertainty about how much gas China really needs, which is something that can be addressed in contract terms, although only in ways that aren't really favorable to Russia, because the more flexibility China has, the less certainty Russia has about its earnings from the pipeline. But, you know, one of the big perceived obstacles has been, you know, that an agreement like this could trigger backlash from the United States, backlash from European countries, especially in the context of Russia's ongoing war in Ukraine. It could appear to many of those governments to be an additional kind of form of support on China's part for Russia that raises risks like new sanctions, perhaps, you know, targeting Russian and or Chinese companies that are involved in the project. So the fact that the Chinese government has decided to proceed with an agreement like that, and, you know, presumably the next steps will be negotiating kind of detailed terms and ultimately signing contracts, that seems to mean that Chinese leaders are less concerned about sanctions risks now than they might have been at other times during the last 3.5 years since Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine. And that's certainly something that I think U.S. and Western policymakers should take pretty seriously. Another thing to think about in terms of why it matters is, you know, China has a lot of different choices about where it buys natural gas to the extent that it needs it. You know, one choice is where to get it from, you know, the United States, Qatar, Australia, Russia. Talked about that just a second ago. They seem to be choosing Russia. But once China chooses Russia, then there's another choice. Do they want natural gas from Russia to come via this very long and expensive pipeline, you know, across thousands of kilometers of Russia and Mongolia and China? Or do they want it to come in the form of liquefied natural gas on LNG tankers from the Russian Arctic? And I think it's interesting and important that Chinese leaders have apparently opted for the direction of the pipeline, because if they opted for the tankers, you know, LNG tankers that go from Russia's Arctic regions to China, they go along the northern coast of Russia. They go through the Bering Strait, and then they go south and southwest to China. That requires those ships go through this very narrow strait that, of course, has Russia on one side of it and Alaska on the other side of it. And Alaska has a number of U.S. air bases in it. So in any kind of a hypothetical conflict scenario in which the United States and China confronted one another militarily, that shipping route would be kind of vulnerable to the United States, certainly more vulnerable than a pipeline running across Russian territory, you know, hundreds of kilometers or more inside that territory in places that are harder for U.S. forces to reach, although, you know, certainly not impossible for U.S. forces to reach. So that's another kind of really interesting choice on the part of Chinese leaders. And one has to wonder to what extent it's a choice that was shaped by these kinds of security considerations, energy security considerations. You know, certainly something that we should be kind of thinking about and reflecting on. Third question, what kind of can or should the United States do in all of this? Is there anything that the United States can or should do? I think, you know, there are a variety of things we can do. The first one, which I just alluded to, is actually to pay close attention to how the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline develops. And, you know, certainly U.S. companies will have to be watching that closely, the exporters, because it will, again, you know, affect the extent to which China has unmet demand for gas from the U.S. or other exporters. But, you know, there's certainly also more than that we can do. One thing that it highlights immediately is, you know, President Trump has been kind of courting leaders in Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, and encouraging them to participate in a very major U.S. LNG project in Alaska. Will that happen? Will that not happen? Hard to say. But the China-Russia deal does put a spotlight on that. And if the Chinese-Russian one happens, and the U.S./Asian allies one doesn't, you know, I think some people will take note of that politically. Another thing certainly to think about on the part of the Congress and the administration is kind of how, you know, quickly can the United States move in ensuring that, you know, projects that companies want to do are permitted quickly and built quickly, so that American LNG is getting out there into markets and winning places in markets and not losing out as global markets kind of reshape and reorient as this Russian-Chinese project moves forward, assuming that it does move forward. And it certainly seems to have crossed a major hurdle, not yet a final done deal. But, you know, I think what's kind of most important at all of all for the United States, and this applies, you know, well beyond the narrow area of LNG exports to international commerce generally, and American economic growth generally, actually, is having a predictable and stable policy environment in which our energy companies and other companies can invest, can make decisions, and can do everything that they need to do to pursue their business, you know, without wondering what's going to happen next month or 2 months or 3 months from now when they're trying to make investments for 10 years, for 20 years, for 30 years, or even some cases longer. I think having that kind of stable policy environment, it's something that the United States, you know, generally speaking, has enjoyed for a long time, somewhat less so in recent months, but really something that is quite important for anyone who's thinking about spending a significant amount of money to do something that takes a long time to come to fruition. So that's my third and final point for today. Again, Paul Saunders with the Center for the National Interest. And thank you very much for joining me for today's Three Questions podcast.